Most stories do not start with a journalist. They start with people noticing when a river runs dry, asking why a school is changing, discovering something new next door. Curiosity is human. Your right to keep asking questions is at the heart of NPR's mission, and we are not going anywhere.
It's time for KPBS Midday Edition. On today's show, the arts and culture shaping San Diego. I'm Jade Hindman with conversations that keep you informed, inspired, and make you think. Hear what's happening at the Filipino-American Friendship Festival. Then our movie critics give a review of The Odyssey, plus your weekend preview. That's ahead on Midday Edition. So for the last 6 years, the Filipino-American Friendship Festival has commemorated the signing of the Treaty of Manila, an act that freed the Philippines from U.S. colonial rule. Well, this Saturday, it's happening at Liberty Station's NTC Park. Festival organizer Joanne Fields is here to tell us all about it. She's the Government and Public Relations Director for the Asian Pacific Islander Initiative. Also with us is Noemi Dumoplin. She's the producer for the documentary Love All. The film will also have a presence at the festival. Joanne, Noemi, welcome.
Thank you for having us, Jade.
So glad to have you both here in studio. So listen, the Treaty of Manila was signed on July 4th, 1946. Remind us of the significance of that day and why you wanted to commemorate it through this festival, Joanne.
Well, it's like our Independence Day. We were once a territory of the United States, just like Puerto Rico and Guam currently are. They're territories. But when the Treaty of Manila was signed July 4th, 1946, we gained our independence and became our own self-governing country, the Republic of the Philippines. So this history isn't taught. And as adults, where are you going to learn that? We're not going to school anymore. It's definitely not being taught in school for our kids to learn. So that's why we want to commemorate this with all of San Diego and all the guests that are coming, because it's a teachable moment and it's a fun time, because we also celebrate the accomplishments and contributions of Filipinos in San Diego.
America recently commemorated 250 years since declaring independence from British rule. How are you thinking about that anniversary coming into this festival?
Well, it's amazing that it's 250 for the United States and then our 80th anniversary for the Treaty of Manila. And coming into this, it gives us a platform to share our history, our contributions, because many times when we say, who's Asian? I hear Chinese, Japanese, Vietnamese, Pacific Islander, Native Hawaiian, Samoan, Tongan, Chamorro, but not Philippines. And with this Treaty of Manila, our commemoration, it shows that we're resilient because Spain tried to rule us, Japan tried to take us over, the United States tried to govern us. So there's a lot. It's really packed with a lot of information, and I feel like it ties in because it's our Independence Day. And again, as adults, when are we going to learn this info?
Exactly. There will also be a lot of important stories highlighted at the festival, local ones, including the Redondo families. They are the subjects of the Love All documentary. What can you tell us about the Redondos and their place in San Diego's Filipino community, Noemi?
So Love All is the untold story of the Redondo family. They're Filipino-American tennis legends from National City. They rose to fame in the 1970s under the care and encouragement of their Filipina grandmother, Mamita. And while this story is very much about extraordinary tennis players. It's really about something much bigger, about family and resilience, identity, community, and sacrifice. And these are all experiences that a lot of Filipino American families can relate to.
And we actually spoke with the director and one of the family members on Midday earlier this month. How did you first get involved with the film?
Well, I'm from San Diego. I was part of a military family, just like many Filipino Americans in San Diego, raised in Southeast San Diego. And so I really found my village and my voice as a leader through different clubs at Bell Junior High and Morris High School under the mentorship of my teachers, the late Ginong Lopez de Lute, the late Ginong Sally Itos. And there I was able to really appreciate the culture and really, you know, appreciate just everything about being a Filipino American. I was fortunate enough that my parents kept us very connected to the Filipino community through clubs like the Bicol Club of San Diego and the Nabueños of Southern California, where I could appreciate the food and traditions and just the sense of community. So fast forward a few years, I found my love for filmmaking. I worked with 50 Square Feet Productions and had known Matt and Sara for a while. And they approached me with this project, and I knew it was a no-brainer because this really connected everything that I was passionate about, my Filipino heritage, filmmaking, and really uplifting the story that deserves to be remembered.
Right. And last year, you actually had a table set up at this festival, and you met a whole lot of people, many of whom knew the family personally. What did you hear from them?
You know, a lot of people who approached us gave us that, oh, finally, this family needs to be known. They have contributed so much, not just to tennis, but to the entire landscape of San Diego community in general. And they are still very active in the community, and they have a service-oriented heart. And so there was a lot of appreciation, and it was balanced with a lot of people who had no idea that we had our own Filipino-American representation in Wimbledon coming from National City. And, you know, a lot of people don't know that we have a Filipino-American in the San Diego Football Club. So these are things that we are so excited to have the story out, and really just we want to bring it back to our community and to the region.
And Joanne, the festival is the place to really springboard these stories.
Yes, absolutely. And I want to chime in with Walter Redondo, who you had here on the Midday News. He's also an artist, and he is bringing one of his paintings, a 10 by 10 painting that will be in the middle of what we're starting as an art gallery. So we have live murals being made, one aerosol with our friends from the Chavez Family Industries, and then Dr. Joanne Tuafilis, who is an elder, and she owns a mural museum in Oceanside, and she's going to paint a live mural. So who knew? And this, it's all just coming together. And again, we're showcasing Filipino games. We have our Rhodes Scholars, Mar Mesa High School students in our Rhodes Scholar program. They're going to teach Filipino games. That's how you preserve your culture and heritage and have fun. Yes, we'll have karaoke. Yes, we're going to line dance. Yes, we'll have food. But there's so much more to our community. And this is one place to learn about it. And then you can do more fact-finding. You can watch the documentary Love All on KPBS's app. It's streaming now. But if you didn't know where to look, or if you didn't know there was this story, then it's a missed opportunity. But this is our opportunity to embrace our culture and share it with all of San Diego, because this is not just for the Filipino community. This is for the whole community. to enjoy. It's a free family festival. All you have to do is bring your own chair. We say BYOB, bring your own banig. But, it'll be a fun time. And it's for all ages.
And it seems like community and friendship, because this is the Friendship Festival. That's like central to this festival. Tell me a bit more about that and how you're elevating that idea.
Oh, just like I mentioned, we have the Chavez Family Industries coming in to paint with us. They're showing friendship and relationship through art and their murals. We have line dancing with the Tronque Foundation and the Harana Band, a Filipino band singing Spanish songs. We like to cha-cha. We like to listen to Latin music, and Tronque Foundation led by Ozzy Meneses. How fun is it that we might not speak the language together at all times, but we can dance to the same beat together, and we love to dance. So these are just various ways that we can strengthen relationships. And then also it's a reunion of sorts. Some people haven't seen each other for so long. And being at NTC Park, many Filipinos graduated boot camp there. They see each other, and it's been decades since they've seen each other. So again, strengthening relationship, friendships, all convening on July 18th at NTC Park Liberty Station.
And why have you all chosen to hold this festival there? There's some significance there.
Oh, absolutely. The history, again, that many Filipinos, there's over 200,000, 17,000 Filipinos residing in the county of San Diego. The majority came by way of the military. They went to boot camp at NTC Park. Logistically, it's great because our Filipino friends up north in Penasquitos, Oceanside, Escondido, Mayor Mesa, they say Chula Vista, National City is too far south, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. National City, if you're from Palm City, Nestor, all the way Cedro, they're saying that's too far north if we go to Mayor Mesa or PQ. So it's the middle ground, and it's beautiful. You know, we have this Southern California weather and landscape. We need to enjoy the amenities. And it's right there historically at NTC.
Yeah, absolutely. Noemi, what does the theme of community and friendship mean to you?
Well, I really found my village in junior high and high school, and being with my friends who all had the same like mind of preserving the Filipino-American experience, and we did that through folk dance. It was such a wonderful time to be coming up in San Diego, and this event, I'm really looking forward to seeing all the different spaces that Joanne and her incredible team have put together, including the storyteller space, and just bringing people from many different backgrounds together and just celebrating culture and heritage and just enjoying a really fun day of making new friends and you know, a beautiful San Diego summer day.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We have a jeepney. I'm so excited to share that. The Filipino Workers Center, they're bringing a jeepney, and that is the mode of transportation in the Philippines. Uh-huh. But we have two coming locally, and the Filipino Workers Center is sponsoring that. So it's a great photo op, and it's again an opportunity to talk about our history, our culture, and tell the kids, like, if you haven't been to the Philippines, we're bringing pieces of the Philippines to you, mm-hmm. including the food, like Porky's lechon.
Yeah, all of that.
Yes.
Let me ask you this question, because that is so important to really teach the younger generation and, well, everybody about, you know, the history and the culture within the community. And it can't just be like with one event, right? So tell me about the efforts. You've got a documentary out. I mean, tell me about the efforts to educate out that grow from this event.
So I have a monthly networking luncheon. I learned that from Dr. Smith, the late Dr. Smith, Pastor Smith, Reverend Smith, when he had the Catfish Club. Well, in the Filipino community, we have the Lumpia Club lunch, and it's networking and talking with our leadership, our decision makers, so that we can have a dialogue about policies that impact us and give feedback. So we haven't had something like that before. So we have festivals, but you're not going to really talk about policy there, or you're not going to go to a gala like what Noemi mentioned. We have associations. My parents are from Masinga and Pangasinan. You usually get together for an association gala. You're not going to talk about policy there. Mm-hmm. But with this networking lunch, and we have it every month, now we're able to engage and network. And again, not just for Filipinos, but there are a lot of Filipino professionals that attend. And we can talk. So our topic for next month is with the Port Commission. It just so happens the first Filipino Port Commissioner is Filipino, Dr. Gil Ungab, and he's going to talk about the National City Balance Plan and what are the business opportunities for the National City community and how does that impact the whole San Diego Port community, which entails five cities. So I know that was a mouthful, but it's us trying to engage.
What cities?
San Diego, Imperial Beach, Chula Vista, Coronado, National City.
Okay. You got them in. Yes.
I was afraid I might not mention one. But all those cities, and until we had a voice there, representation, now we're feeling comfortable. How can we engage? How can we get small business participating at a port property? How can we have an event like the Philippine Medical Doctors now? They host a Carabao 5K, and that's their platform to talk about health and wellness. And again, we are just a springboard happening in July. Their event is on October, but we're going to collaborate, we're partnered, and we're going to promote what's next in October.
All right. I've been speaking with Joanne Fields, festival organizer and government and public relations director for the API Initiative, and Noemi Dumoplin, producer for the documentary Love All. The Filipino-American Friendship Festival takes place at NTC Park in Liberty Station this Saturday, July 18th. It'll run from 11 a.m. through 6 p.m. and it is free. We'll include more details on kpbs.org/midday. Joanne, Noemi, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
Still to come, our movie critics give a review of The Odyssey. KPBS Midday Edition is back after the break.
Satisfy your celluloid addiction with the Cinema Junkie podcast, where you can mainline film with the people who make them, as well as those who love them, program them, and celebrate them for their cultural impact. Listen to Cinema Junkie wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. Homer's epic poem, The Odyssey, is one of the oldest surviving works of literature, and it's remained popular over the millennia, inspiring all sorts of movies, shows, and books. In fact, if you name your favorite story, chances are you can find some of The Odyssey's DNA in it. It tells the story of the Greek hero Odysseus and his journey home after the 10-year-long Trojan War. Well, this week, Christopher Nolan's epic IMAX adaptation of the ancient tale arrives in theaters, and that's where Nolan wants you to watch his film. To discuss the film, we have once again gathered our Midday Movies critics, KPBS cinema junkie Beth Accomando, and Movie Wallace's podcaster Yazdi Pathavala. Beth, Yazdi, welcome to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jade.
So let's begin with a little of the trailer for Christopher Nolan's Odyssey.
Tell me what you remember.
A wife. A son.
And then what?
We won the war. Help me go home.
So, Yazdi, do you feel Nolan's film merits making the effort to see it on the big screen in IMAX and 70 millimeter?
The short answer is yes. I should say, though, that I'm not your typical fawning, you know, Nolan devotee, and I've found plenty to gripe about with his more recent films. But even so, there is no denying the majesty, as well as, and this is the surprising part, the emotional heft of his latest, The Odyssey. Dare I say this may be amongst Nolan's best films even. An immediate improvement from his past films is the score for The Odyssey from Ludwig Göransson. And for once, there is no clanging, deafening background music that drowns out the dialogue. Hooray! Because that was an issue with a few of his last films. Nolan still cannot resist, though, the needless back and forth in time through the entire running time of this film, which makes the first half hour of the film pretty hard to decipher. But having said all that, as far as pure cinematic achievement goes, first film shot entirely in IMAX, the use of mostly practical effects over CGI, and a three-hour film shot almost exclusively on location, it is hard to deny The Odyssey its flowers.
I mean, a full rundown there. Beth, what are your thoughts?
Okay, I'm going back to my normal self of being a little more negative than Yazdi. So I had really mixed feelings about this. I know you talked about like the emotional heft, and that's the place where it fell short for me. Mm. I was impressed by the scale and the spectacle and the technical skill. I mean, it was impressive to see this on the big screen. But I never fully felt engaged in the emotional weight of the story. And while some have complained about the casting of Lupita Nyong'o as Helen of Troy because she's black and the cinematic image has always been of a blonde, fair-skinned woman, this has been a somewhat racist backlash towards her casting, which has been an unfair criticism of Nolan casting her in this role. But aside from that, I was upset about the casting of American actors Matt Damon and Anne Hathaway as Greeks. It's not so much that they're not Greek, but they just did not strike me as the right people for these particular roles. And I had heard that Nolan had considered Tom Hardy for the role of Odysseus, and now that would have been a different film that I might have been able to embrace more fully. Robert Pattinson got it right as the kind of slimy villain, but for the two leads, I just wasn't as emotionally invested in them as I was hoping to be. And I did hear Nolan in an interview, and he was talking about how he was obsessed to make this movie from a very young age, and I was going like, oh, wow, you've loved Homer's The Odyssey this long? And then he said his obsession was making a film all in IMAX. I feel like it was the format he was in love with at the age of 16. I thought he was going to say he was obsessed with this Greek story. So a lot of the promotion about the film, a lot of the discussion has all been about the logistics, how big it is, how epic it is, the technology that was used. And I just feel like maybe some of the emotional weight of the story got lost. Plus, for me, I felt like the film didn't give us much context to know what's going on. So who is Helen? Like, why was this war fought? What's the role of the gods in this whole thing? I mean, they're kind of expecting us to know this from when we read these books back in like high school or something. But you're thrown into it. And I feel like he could have done better at that. And I think, Yazdi, when you're talking about the back and forth in time, the other thing about that is it doesn't help clarify a lot of those things, and we don't feel like it's this long journey, which is part of what the whole story is about, like taking so long to return home when you're jumping about all the time. So I will say, I think he wanted this to sort of be a spiritual sequel to Oppenheimer because Odysseus is a man who's carrying the weight of all this destruction that was caused through him during the Trojan War. But again, I just never felt like we knew enough about him to fully understand what Nolan wanted to make the film about. I do understand that he wanted to make it in 70mm IMAX and a movie grounded in the real world as much as possible. But for me, that just wasn't enough.
You said that he didn't really explain, like, why this war is fought, the role of the gods. Isn't that all, though, very, like, interpretive from one viewer to the next, that part of the story.
I mean, how you see some of those things playing out can be interpretive on the part of the audience. But I think if you don't know why or what role Helen played in why the Trojan War was fought, then you're kind of at a loss for understanding, like, why do these people hate each other? Why do they want to kill each other? Why are they willing to go to war? And in the story, the gods play a role in how all this plays out. I mean, one of the things about the gods that's so much fun in Greek mythology is they're like petty humans.
They're mischievous. Yeah.
Yeah, they are doing things because they want to mess with you, or, you know, they've got personal vendettas. And those things play out in the context of that world, whether you want to believe it's fate or that man has free will or anything like that. That's totally up to interpretation. And I don't even know how that plays out in this film.
So he didn't even explore it.
No.
Yeah, no. And I think the movie does expect you to come with some prior knowledge. Like, you're never explained anything about Helen of Troy. I mean, she has very few scenes in the movie.
Yeah, hardly any.
Likewise, people keep talking about Agamemnon, and we don't really know how he sits within, you know, everything else. Maybe a Star Wars-like feed at the start of the movie, which laid everything out, would have helped.
Athena pops in now and again, but again, we don't understand, like, her connection to him or to the story, or, you know, they talk about Zeus's law and how he's supposed to be telling the humans that you have to be kind to everyone because anyone could be a god. But those things are just dropped in there. I mean, it's not a part of the real fabric of the story. I just felt like his attention was elsewhere.
Interesting. Well, you actually went to see this film with someone who who builds suits of armor?
Yes.
To get his take on how it works in the film?
I thought it would be fun to go with someone who actually handcrafts armor to see a film where, you know, this is a part of the film. And so Jeffrey Hedgecock has 40 years of experience crafting armor very authentically to whatever time period he happens to be working in. He's done armor work on Army of Darkness, the Evil Dead film, and The Cell. And he does extensive historical research whenever he builds armor. And so he shared some thoughts with me about how armor can function in a film.
Well, there's been a lot of talk about what the armor looks like online. And you can pick apart the historical accuracy of it, but it's a film. And for me, I always look at how the armor is used in the film and how does it help tell the story? How does it help develop the characters? What does it say about the characters? And of course, whether it is used in a way that signifies that the armor is indeed protection. If it's not protection, then it's just an article of clothing. The armor needs to help tell the story. Armor is usually under the subheading of the costume designer. It sort of falls between the cracks in the wardrobe department. It's usually considered specialty wardrobe. In any case, it really needs to help tell the story, whether or not it's historically accurate. A movie is not a documentary. It's not there to tell us exactly the way things were, just give us an impression of history and an impression of how our ancestors lived.
And he thought that the armor used for the giants in the film was particularly effective because it is used in part as a display of power and invincibility. But he did criticize in the Battle of Troy. He said he got a little pulled out of the story because the Trojan armor couldn't protect them from the most basic weapon that was being used, which were bow and arrows. So he felt that it should have been more functional in that context. But, you know, the Trojan soldiers also looked very, like, washed out in these white, grayish armor. And it was almost like Nolan had condemned them to death from the beginning. They were like specters and spirits and ghosts from the time that the war started. So maybe it was costuming there and, you know, symbolically showing us these were all doomed to die.
Had Nolan leaned more into the mystical, supernatural part of this?
Maybe it would have worked better.
It would have worked better. It would have. Well, Yazdi, I mean, how do you place this film in Nolan's filmography?
So there's no mistaking that this is a Nolan film. All the usual Nolanisms are here. There's no opening credits. We talked about this fussy back and forth in time, which really doesn't do this particular story in, you know, in particular any justice. And then we have the sprawling cast with many new characters introduced fairly late in the plot. Mm-hmm. And as we've said before, so many of those characters are just left generally untethered with the rest of the plot. So it's hard to kind of get your arms around it. But I also think there is a certain maturity in storytelling here. I'm not giving anything away by saying the last half hour of the movie is almost entirely devoted to more emotional beats compared to, you know, large-scale action. So I kind of did appreciate that. Many have taken a lot out of Homer's classic, but I was surprised that Nolan kind of highlighted the principal underlying theme of the Odyssey to be something quite unexpected, which is Odysseus's great guilt from having won a war that came at the cost of killing so many innocent people. As Beth mentioned earlier, this curiously was also the theme on his take on Oppenheimer. So it's interesting that Nolan continues to wrestle with, even as we have wars going on right now, he continues to wrestle with the price we pay with the people who die during wars. Having said all that, again, in terms of sheer scale, the Odyssey definitely trumps everything else that Nolan has done, which is saying quite a lot. And after finding his last few films to be somewhat hollow spectacles, I was hoping and praying that Nolan would go back to his roots and make smaller films such as Memento and The Following and Prestige. Instead, he made the biggest film of his career to date. And, you know, to give credit where it's due, I think he did nail the assignment against all odds. Like Beth, I heard another interview with Nolan where he actually said that once he gets older, all he will be making is smaller films. And right now, while he has the energy and vigor, he wants to make the big ones. So okay. I understand that.
There's promises, that. Promises.
Yeah. There's logic in that. Well, Beth, how does The Odyssey rank for you in Nolan's canon?
All right. Well, it hasn't changed my ranking of my favorite film. Memento still remains my personal favorite. I think that film was perfection. And that's where the nonlinear narrative, the breaking up of time worked so well because it was so part of the character and part of the theme of the film. So that still is the pinnacle for me. I also love The Dark Knight, but I think that was more for Heath Ledger. So I feel like Nolan is an extremely talented filmmaker, but I feel like the recent growth in scale of his films has meant that he's sort of lost the intimacy. And I feel like he is a little more obsessed with that bigger picture aspect of it and with the technology. I mean, I think he does love the whole process of filmmaking, the technology used to bring that vision to life. But sometimes I do feel like he loses a little of the humanity along the way.
Yeah.
So I wasn't a big fan of like Tenet or Inception or Interstellar, but The Prestige, Dunkirk, and Memento at the top.
Hmm. Well, you know, The Odyssey, as you mentioned, it touches on Greek mythology this go around. But it's always been popular in movies. Do you have a favorite film you'd recommend as a companion piece or counterpoint to Nolan's film here?
I'm a big fan of The Clash of the Titans from 1981.
Clash of the Titans. The combat. The courage. The splendor. The spectacle.
Which really embraces the fantastical elements of Greek mythology. It almost feels like the gods and humans are on the same playing field. And the practical effects used in that film, which actually may even seem silly by current standards, they're extremely endearing. So I just love watching that movie. Anytime it's on television, I'll watch it. And I think this use of practical effects kind of harkens back all the way to Jason and the Argonauts from 1963, which used impossibly clever practical effects from Ray Harryhausen, which stand up, you know, even to this day. But one of Nolan's true achievements with his Odyssey is that the fantastical elements of the plot are made quite realistic and inherently believable, even when you're dealing with things like the Cyclops or Circe. And again, that speaks to the technical proficiency of what you see on the screen.
All right, Beth?
Well, I will second some of Yazdi's choices here. The Ray Harryhausen films are absolutely my favorite. I am wearing my Ray Harryhausen Jason and the Argonauts shirt today. It glows in the dark, too. Jason and the Argonauts, when I was a kid, that totally captured my imagination. He uses stop-motion animation to bring the harpies to life, the skeletons, all sorts of things, and they're fabulous. Plus, in Jason and the Argonauts, you have Pussy Galore herself, Honor Blackman, as Hera, Queen of the Gods. So those two remain my favorite in the world of Greek mythology. I know some people may like think they're a little silly in terms of the production values. I think they're magical. There's also Kirk Douglas in Ulysses, and I think that's also worth checking out as being, I think, a little more faithful to kind of the narrative of Homer's original poem.
Marvel at the tremendous spectacle of the Trojan War. Ulysses and his warriors springing from the mammoth wooden horse to overwhelm the walls of Troy. See Ulysses live his fantastic adventures again, filmed where they actually happened 5,000 years ago. The 1001 Thrills of Ulysses, the greatest of all adventurers, mightiest of all warriors, biggest of all motion pictures, Ulysses!
But for well-oiled Greek history and mythology, there are no better films than 300.
This is Sparta!
Perhaps the only Zack Snyder film I like, and Troy as a second, although it's less successful in that realm. And then I do want to throw out, I'm going to be like Yazdi today. I'm going to throw in some extra stuff. My two offbeat suggestions are Xena the Warrior Princess, the TV series. I adored that show. And then Terry Gilliam's Time Bandits had an absolutely wonderful segment with Sean Connery as King Agamemnon.
Where did you come from?
I'm not quite sure.
Who sent you? The gods? Zeus, Apollo, Athena.
That is just a beautiful, so heartfelt section of that film.
Interesting. And well, to go out, Yazdi, India has a wealth of mythology to draw on. Can you recommend any films?
Yeah, to get your cup of mythology, Indian cinema is where you should go. And I think the most recent example is the Bahubali films. There were three of them. Those films were made from the same director as RRR. And all of those films can be watched right now on Netflix. But I should say that Indian cinema has been rife with films based on mythology from the very beginning. But the more recent films like Kantara from 2025, Kalki from 2024, and Brahmastra Part 1 from 2022 have done a great job with using the available contemporary technology to create these incredible tales of tremendous dazzle while still retaining the emotional strength of those antique stories. In fact, one of the most eagerly awaited Indian film this year is a retelling of the Ramayana with some of the biggest names in Bollywood attached to it. And that film opens in November. So something to look forward to.
And just an FYI for you, Ramayana has a panel on Thursday at Comic-Con next week. And the last time that India took the stage at the pop culture convention, it was pretty epic with live music and dance.
All right. Sounds great. The Odyssey opens tomorrow, which is Friday. Be sure to check for the IMAX screenings. I'd like to thank our midday movie critics, Beth Accomando and Yazdi Pathavla. Beth, Yazdi, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, your weekend preview when KPBS Midday Edition returns.
Before a producer hits record or before a journalist picks up a pen, someone like you notices something and wants to understand it. Every day, we invite you to keep asking questions like why and who and how. Because NPR begins with questions, not conclusions. And your right to curiosity is a right worth protecting.
Welcome back. You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. For our weekend arts preview, we have skateboarding, culture on the border, Final Fantasy music, and a teenage girl genius in the 19th century. Joining me with all the details is KPBS arts reporter and host of the finest podcast, Julia Dixon Evans. Julia, welcome.
Hey, Jade. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here as always. So let's start with the skateboard art. Tell us about border crossings.
Yeah, so for listeners, it's spelled B-O-A-R-D-E-R, like a skateboard. Mm-hmm. And it's just opening this weekend at Centro Cultural de la Raza in Balboa Park. But it's part of a bigger project out of San Diego State University's Fred J. Hansen Peace Chair. It's basically a love letter to the role of skateboarding culture right here on the border. And vice versa, the role of the border in skateboarding culture, the literal skateboard itself, how it can bridge connections, community, be part of this like border exchange. There's a ton of art involved, and all of the art is board-based, like made out of skateboards. There's 52 pieces, and they're divided between the San Diego exhibit in Balboa Park, and then a sister exhibit that's at Secut in Tijuana. And that exhibit's up through the end of September. So you have time if you want to also go and check that one out. Artists include Brisk One, Chicle, Michelle Guerrero, or Mr. B-Baby, Penka, Seth Sullivan, known as the Art Pusher, and then also Spencer Little, who makes these really incredible wire-based sculptures. So I'm really curious to see what he does with the skateboard. And a ton more. And it opens with a reception this Friday from 3 to 8 at Centro Cultural de la Raza.
Ah, sounds really cool. All right, at the Rady Shell, the San Diego Symphony is celebrating the music of video games. So tell me more about that. That's interesting.
Right, and they have such great music.
Yeah.
This concert is called Distant Worlds, Music from Final Fantasy. This year is the 25th anniversary of one installment of that series, Final Fantasy X. This is a Japanese sci-fi fantasy game series, really revolutionized like the role-playing video game genre. It debuted as a franchise in 1987, and music's always been a really big part of that game. There are these themes that are shared across all of the different installments, like kind of variations. They have a prelude, there's the march. And this weekend, it's Friday night, the symphony is going to perform a bunch of the pieces from different Final Fantasy games. It's conducted by Arnie Roth, and they're bringing in Ricky, who's the original vocalist, who sang on this piece, Tsuteki Dene. So the performance is Friday at 7:30 p.m. at the Rady Shell downtown. And as with almost all concerts at the Shell, you can just take a little walk on the public path during the conference or during the concert, and you can hear the music for free. So if you're looking for a cultured way to kick off your Comic-Con week, there you go.
And that is such a lovely thing to do. It's a walk on that path. Yeah, and catch the music. There's also a unique production pairing the opera and ballet this weekend in the North County. Is that correct?
Yeah. So this is from Sin Bellera Entertainment, their local opera and ballet company, founded by two sisters just a couple years ago in 2023. And they're doing this weekend a one-act opera by Puccini called Il Tabarro, which means the cloak. And this piece is not actually performed very often. It's part of a triptych of other one-act operas that he wrote. It's set on a river barge in Paris where the lives of like the dock workers and barge owners are entangled. There's romance, there's jealousy, there's betrayal. You gotta love it. And the way that this production is pulling this off is the first half of the show will be the opera. So co-founder and soprano Tiffany Brannon will play the part of the barge owner's wife, the lead. And then after an intermission, there's the ballet version. So the other co-founder, the other sister, ballerina Rebecca Brennan, will take a turn with the leading lady. The performance is Sunday at 3 p.m. at California Center for the Arts, Escondido.
All right. And then Signet Theater is opening a production of Arcadia. What do you know about that?
Yeah. So this is Tom Stoppard's play from 1993, Arcadia. This play won the Laurence Olivier Award. It was also nominated for a Tony a couple years later. And it takes place in one single house across hundreds of years. So part of the story starts in the early 1800s. They're following this extremely smart teenage girl, Thomasina Coverley. And the way that she made all of these objects observations that were like super ahead of her time, like scientific observations. And we also then jump ahead to two centuries later as these researchers come to the house to try to unravel like the truth about who she was and what happened to her. The play just opened this week. It's in lower cost previews for a couple more days, and it will be up on stage at Signet in Liberty Station through August 9th.
Sounds fascinating. And here's a fun one for kids or anyone who loves libraries and zines.
Yeah. So this
zines.
This is Dine author Julie Fiveash. They're coming to town on tour with a new graphic novel called The Froggy Library. And it's informed by their work studying both zine making and indigenous library studies. So in the book, we follow a young frog named Anura who gets a summer job working at the library near their grandmother's house. And at the library, Anura takes on this big archiving project. It's all about their little corner of the world. And we follow along as Anura learns about memory and community and what it means to archive. There's also like zine making in the book, like frog zine making. Gotta love that. And Five Ash is having two events in San Diego libraries on Friday. The first is 1 p.m. at Skyline Hills branch, and then at 4:30, they'll be at the Central Library downtown, and both events are free.
All right. And finally, what's on your radar for live music?
So there's a show at Soda Bar on Saturday. It's a solo show with Australian indie rocker Alex Leahy. Her debut album, I Love You Like a Brother, from 2017, is one of my all-time favorites. We're listening to a track from that album called Every Day is the Weekend. So this is at Soda Bar on Saturday, and it's even kind of an early show. Doors are at 6:30.
All right. You can find details on these and more arts events on our website at kpbs.org. I've been speaking with KPBS arts reporter and host of the finest podcast, Julia Dixon Evans. Julia, thank you.
Thank you, Jade.
That's our show for today. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. Thanks for tuning in to Midday Edition. Be sure to have a great day on purpose, everyone.
Most stories do not start with a journalist. They start with people. Noticing when a river runs dry. Asking why a school is changing. Discovering something new next door. Curiosity is human. Your right to keep asking questions is at the heart of NPR's mission. And we are not going anywhere.